manage the risk. Not wild speculative risk. You can buy lottery tickets. You can gamble. Hell, you can, all kinds of ways you can make money. You can steal it. Those are, you know, heavier risks. You can go to prison, right? You can get shot. I'm talking about managed risk. You have to say, what are my capabilities and what should I be doing? If you're a good salesperson and you're a closer, you have got to work on a commission-only job. Because otherwise, you'll be getting underpaid. The way the risk works from the employer's point of view is this. If I have to give salaries, and I give everybody, say, $5,000 a month, there's 10 guys, that's $50,000 out, right? I can only afford maybe a 10% commission rate. Right? So if a guy sells $50,000, he'll make maybe $5,000, he'll make $10,000 a month. If I wasn't at risk for that salary, I could easily say, well, if you're willing to risk, I'll double the commission rate if you're taking all the risk. It's just a simple risk-reward thing. Now, what a rep would want is he'd want the salary and the high commission rate. He'd want to have to take no risk but get overpaid. Of course he would. That's why he needs to move to Sweden or Denmark, where they have socialist economies where they tax you at about 80% of your wages, but they provide free, quote-unquote, health insurance and free this and free that, right? And nobody takes a risk. Nobody is going to take any risk, or nobody's ambitious there, because why would you be ambitious if you already have food and a house and, you know what I mean, long-term, you know, payments for doing nothing, and they have free college. Nobody pays for college. Yeah, they have 5 million people, a totally homogenous society, and they're living off their the fat that they generated in earlier years. See how long that lasts. Wait till China. China is going to eat them as an hors d'oeuvre one day. They're going to be a suburb of Beijing. All right. The risk reward. If you want to make these gains, you have to take the risk. If you're a poser, and I'll define the word poser. A poser is someone who doesn't belong in sales, who pretends he's something he's not. He's a poser. He looks good. He'll even pretend, you know, oh, look at me, I'm working hard. But he won't deliver. And then there's a closer, poser and closer. Posers love salaries. And then what they'll do is they'll take their salary job and they'll pretend they work and they'll pretend they're making calls and they'll do just enough to kind of get by until they get found out eventually. And then they'll get fired. Then they'll go to the next job and they'll keep doing the same thing over and over again. They'll just do the bare minimum. Then I'll do a couple calls. Why should they? So truth be said, they can live on the salary. They don't need the commission. Commissions are nice, but it's not, the salary's good enough. And then they wonder why they can't get people to perform. Because, the guy's already fed. He's got a place to stay. You've already paid his bills, so why do you expect he wants to work now? He's going to screw up. Maslow's hierarchy of needs. They need a salary because they know they don't want to work hard, or they're just not capable of it. They know they're never going to be in the top 10% anyway, so what's the point? They're better off just coasting, and economically they're rewarded to do that. A closer in that environment loses because he's the one who could have made $20,000 a month. But now he's at a commission rate that's lower than it should be because he has to pay for all the posers out of his own pocket, basically. So it's kind of like the situation set up where the closers lose and the posers gain by being in a socialistic environment. You know what I mean? If you're not highly ambitious, then you're better off in that kind of economy. And if you want to go off and really push your limits and have the rewards that go with that, you're better off in a more, you know, capitalistic libertarian economy. That's just the way it is. That's just the numbers. I'm not making a moral judgment here. I'm just looking at the math. If it takes doing something unusual to get in the top 1%, by definition, you are unusual. There's 99 people, and then there's you. What did you do that they didn't do? You took risks. You worked all the extra hours. You know what I mean? You were passionate. You were just talented. Whatever it was, you stood out. You've got that. And even in the top 10%, you can make a pretty good living. That's 10 out of 100. Stood out. I mean, you're aiming for the top one. Maybe you're in the top three. That's good. But you want to aim for the top one. That's what you want to train for. When you're training for the Olympics, do you train for the silver or do you train for the gold? If you get the silver, well, great. If you get the bronze, well, great. It's better than nothing. But what did you go there for? You went there for the gold, right? So you have to do something unusual to be in the top 1%, which means that to be in the middle class, to be in the top 1% by definition means you're doing things that a 99% can't or won't do. It means you're unusual. You are atypical, unusual. You're an aberration, okay? And yet, to be in the middle class basically requires you to be in the top 1%, because then you're making that 300 grand, which puts you solidly in the middle class. You know, give or take a few points, okay? And again, that's assuming you don't want to have two people in the household working to do what one person used to do. You don't want to work 80 hours a week instead of 40. You don't want to go without that retirement fund or the education fund. You don't want to live off your second mortgages and, you know, equity loans against your home and credit cards and other debt. You don't want to forego vacations or not have a new car. Of course, you can always pare down. You can go live in a hut. So what I'm saying is that unless you're aiming for the top 1%, you're going to get pushed out of the middle class, and it's only going to get worse. And that's what this is about. That's how serious I take this whole concept of the top 1%. I'm not trying to make people rich. If anybody hears, oh, you could buy a Cadillac and a yacht and your own island, and when has anybody ever heard me exhorting and you know, building up the idea of being rich? You probably heard me say big numbers, like, oh, you can make 50 grand a month or 80 grand a month. Only because the math says you can make that kind of number. I can't help it. I've also said you can make 20 grand a month, depending on what the numbers tell me. But I'm not really encouraging people to be rich, because I really personally feel the concept of being rich, since it's based on ego, is an empty life. I've been there. There's nothing there. Okay? Kind of like going to New Jersey. Ready? The reason I say that is because I love New Jersey. Detroit Magazine many years ago did an article called The 50 Biggest Cities, Which One's Most Livable? And in their own magazine, they came in 49, and Newark came in 50. So from then on, I always liked people from New Jersey. My wife is from New Jersey. That's how far I took it. It's the only place worse than Detroit. As long as I aimed myself west, I couldn't possibly go wrong. That's what I figured when I left Detroit. All right. Unless you do something unusual, being in the top 1% by definition is unusual, atypical. It's not normal. The kind of people who do these things are not normal people. There's something wrong with them. They're different. And yet, if they don't do that, they can't comfortably be in the middle class or recover what the middle class lifestyle truly was. Because right now, I think people just forgot. They figure, well, if we get the wife and the kids, we all work 5 jobs each, and we live in this tiny little 800-square-foot house, and, you know, don't go out to eat ever, then we won't be middle class. No, you're not. You know what I mean? You're artificially pumping yourself into a life you can't sustain. And what happens when someone gets sick? What happens when you get laid off? What happens when interest rates go up on your zero down second? And you find yourself being, you know, your house payment just went up by $900, and at the same time gas prices went up, at the same time you got laid off. You're gone. It's gone. It's over with. You have no reserves in the bank. You have to have some cash left over. You have to have some investments, too, to be middle class. Now, rich, you know, I would say $1 million house, but $1 million house is average middle class where I'm standing right now. You can't buy anything at all for under $1 million. It's ridiculous. I know a lot of areas in the country that's not the case. Let's say you have a $300,000 house. So if you're in certain areas, if you buy $1 million house, you know, wow, you know, he's like upper middle class. You're not really rich until you have what's euphemistically called fuck you money. Okay? I'm not swearing, I'm just telling you that's the term. You can look it up in the F book, which is a dictionary of all words F. Okay. And what does that mean? F you money. F you money means exactly what it sounds like. You have enough money where you don't take anything from other people else. I don't care about your job, bye, I'm gone. You don't like this, you can move. You pretty much have the money to do what the hell you want. I would consider that rich, even though you can do that anyway, not have a whole lot of money. It's just a little bit easier if you have the money. If you're willing to go live in a campground, you can tell your boss F you right now. And in effect, you'd be rich compared to the rest of us who are working like slaves. I'm saying top 1% means middle class. What are you willing to do? What price are you willing to pay then to be in the top 1%? What will a top 1%er do that the rest won't? Well, right there, they are willing to understand there's a price to pay for success, that maybe they're going to miss a few football games. They're going to have to work some evenings on a Saturday. They're going to have to just crank all day long at a fast pace, just moving quick all day long instead of lollygagging, taking long lunches and hanging out. They're willing to pay that price now if they feel that they'll have a payback at the end. They're willing to make the investment now. It's like you can spend months fixing up the house, increase its value by $100,000 when you sell it, you know. You make a good profit for your labor, right? Sweat equity. That was an investment. What is your ultimate goal? What do you want, and what are you willing to do to get there? And what are your options? Okay, so again, I'll open up for questions or comments at this point.
Yeah, Paul, this is Jim in Texas, and I really relate to what you're describing. I think to a significant degree, I'm 60 years old, and I kind of grew up more in a culture where people were a little more willing to kind of bootstrap themselves and work hard, and I guess I'm a little more concerned about the current generation and younger generations that have grown up in an entitlement mentality, in an entitlement culture in society. And I think for those folks, if there are any of those folks really on this call, I expect there are, and you're really wondering if you got what it takes to take advantage of the opportunities that you've gone out and researched and found for us and basically laid them at our feet. But I think we all need to do some soul searching in terms of really thinking about what our core values are and what our core beliefs are about what it takes and what we're willing to do. It comes down to what you are willing to do that the other 90% of you say, as you say, are either unable or unwilling. Now, a certain number of people are going to be unable. You need to address that and face that, and if that's your case, get out now and save yourself a lot of pain and misery. Or if you're unwilling, identify that. And if you're really unwilling when it comes right down to it to put in the sacrifices and the hard work and take the risk, I think that's the big component here. Are you willing to take a risk? And in exchange for that, you face the potential for huge reward. But if you're not willing to take that, again, identify yourself for that and get out now.
Okay, I appreciate that, Jim. Which leads me to one other point. If you were given accolades and, you know, false self-esteem strokes your whole life, oh, Joe, you're so wonderful, look at each great drawing you draw, oh, look at he tried to hit the baseball, and your whole life you're passed from grade to grade without any expectations and no standards, right? And you're always told how wonderful you are. These are the people who end up on American Idol and are completely crushed and bewildered that Simon thinks they can't sing. And what do they say? Well, everybody tells me I could sing good. Everybody, well, who is that? Well, my mother and my dad and my friends. They all told me I could sing. And I was singing at parties. They go, well, they were wrong. And you see them and they're like heartbroken. They just cannot. They, matter of fact, then they get all mad. They start swearing and they go through like these seven stages of grief kind of. I don't know what the hell they're doing, but they're astounded that someone could criticize them. They were pretty much coddled and, given it. So they go out into the real world and these people are, roadkill. They grew up in Disneyland. They find out the world isn't Disneyland. It's more like Newark, like I was trying to say before. Yeah. You go there, they're going to eat you. They're going to barbecue you. So I'll tell people that's why in Detroit we invented the barbecue. That's why you don't see a lot of homeless around. Like that one? I know you don't. That's okay, though. It's a joke. It's finger-licking good. It's a joke. So here's what you have to understand. You've been abused as a child. Your parents, unwittingly probably, are trying to be nice to you, trying to do you a favor, literally abused you and did you a disservice and ill-prepared you for the world as it is. They did not prepare you for reality. They shirked their responsibilities and then dumped the consequences onto you. And that's why a lot of these kids, and I'm going to call them kids, keep living with their parents even though they're in their 20s and even in their 30s, is they can't make it in the outside world. And I see them. They get a job, and they're not going to work hard. Why? Because nobody's ever made them work hard before. They were fed. There was no consequences. They were given what they wanted. And, you know, that's what they go. And it's more prevalent today. I'm not saying it's always been like this to an extent, but it's more prevalent because before there just wasn't the surpluses to allow that to happen. You didn't have the kind of a system set up. These are the people basically who are riding on these boom periods post-World War II where there's a lot of surpluses and excesses where we can afford that kind of idiocy. And so they bought their houses for nothing, and then their houses are worth a lot of money today. And, you know, they're living in an economy, they're divorced from a lot of the reality of the economy because they bought their homes in the 60s and 70s before the price went up. And therefore, you know, they don't really need the kids to work to support the family farm, so the kids had no purpose. The reason a lot of people don't have kids anymore is there's no economic reason to have kids. If you're not plowing the fields or doing some other kind of labor where you can put the kids to work, what the hell, they're just overhead. Economics would say not to have them. And a lot of people, by the way, decide not to have them. They're having a lot fewer kids now than they used to. And so you have this, you know, this useless human being hanging out. You don't know what the hell to do with them. That's why they get isolated out in their own world, you know. Well, the thing I learned in Saudi Arabia is that the teens and all the kids are integrated into the society. They're actually running the little shops. Eight-year-old kids were running the businesses. They were bargaining with me. Come from Lusada. How much is this? Kathir, too much. I give you Kamsa Riyal. Kamsa, five. No, 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 Araba. Kamsa. Araba. Hey, big smile. He gives me a tea, right? I'm bargaining with the six-year-old, right? The six-year-old, bright and alert, running the business. He's not some teen out there pushed away from the rest of society. And then I started wondering, which society was supposed to be civilized and which society was supposed to be primitive? I don't remember now. That's what I remember in Saudi Arabia. I don't remember anymore. These primitive barbarians, oh, really? That's interesting. I'll show you some primitive barbarians. And you won't have to go far from home to find them, by the way. So, the sense of entitlement has basically ruined people. They were coddled and given self-esteem instead of challenges. Self-esteem comes by overcoming challenge, by pushing your limits. Then you get self-esteem. You feel good about yourself because you pushed yourself. That's inner, right? So if you weren't given this as a child, and right now you're going from job to job to job, looking for easy money, but never really exerting yourself, and then blaming everybody else around you for when you fail, and you know who you are, and if you're on this call, which I tend to doubt, but in case you are, or you hear this call later, take control of your life. Just like a woman who's been beat by a husband, a wife beater for many years, and finally learns that, you know what, it's your life, you need to take charge of your life and kick the guy out and move on and have your own life again, have freedom again. Or if you're a recovering alcoholic and you say, I can't drink anymore, or any other similar situation, you're going to have to admit that you were a steamaholic, that you were giving self-esteem instead of challenge, and you have to earn self-esteem. You can't be given it. You have to build your life will go by. You'll never have any accomplishment, which means you'll never have lived your own life. You need to take own your life again and take it back and push yourself, something that you thought you couldn't do, and then go do it anyway. And that's the best challenge, the ones you thought you couldn't do, but you just did them anyway because you just had no choice, you just wanted it bad enough, or you just want to push yourself to see what would happen. And that's where all the big gains, those are the things you'll remember when you're 85, 90, 100 years old in your deathbed. Those are the things, only things you'll remember are those and the people that, you know, loved you and you loved back, or vice versa. Everything else is garbage. This is just one more opportunity in its own way, since you have to make a living anyway. You might as well just push yourself and see what you can do. By doing so, you will pretty much secure your economic future, and your career will be totally secured. Anybody who can do the top 1% level work on any of my teams or a similar situation is pretty much assured that they will get a job anywhere. They will literally fire someone and give you their job. I actually did that when I was with Aldi. I said, I want to transfer. I want to live out in Marin County in California. And he said, well, where do you want to live? In the, you know, western region. I was in Colorado at the time. I want to live out in San Francisco. I came out and I said, I want to live there. He says, well, there's a guy there. I go, so? He says, yeah, you're right. So I'm going to fire him. That's what he did. He fired this guy and gave me his territory. That's how I got my territory. Why? Because I was the number one guy in the whole country. What would you do? This guy was marginal as a hanger-on anyway. Ready? I suggested we kill him and eat him, and then I get his territory. That would have been a little bit more interesting. In the spirit of Beowulf the Red, you know what I mean? The famous Norse Viking. But he wouldn't go for it, so all right. You're no fun. Not in California too long, huh? Yeah, that's what I would say. I'd say you push your limit for your own purposes. Forget about everybody else who ever said you were good or bad or whatever. Just for your own purposes. Start, find the highest standard, the one you think you can't meet, and go meet it anyway. Does anybody have any comment on that besides Jim, who's really doing a good job now, but anybody else want to make a comment? Jim, then you're up again. What do you think of that?
I couldn't really emphasize how much I agree. It really comes down to a cultural matter of what your mentality is. And I believe that people can change. And if you really want something bad enough, you can identify those character flaws, if you will, or those habits. And with reflection and commitment, you can find a way to make yourself change. You can change your character, but it takes some hard work, and there's nothing like the hard work that you've got for us in these jobs to actually apply it and practice it. I think in my sales career, I've experienced significant change from who I was in my 20s and 30s. And recognizing the bad habits that I had, the bad attitudes, the self-destructive attitudes, the limiting attitudes I had. And I got into a lot of self-help material that helped me identify the thought patterns, which are nothing but thinking habits. Identify those things that were holding me back and begin working and applying through the work that I was doing, through the sales work that I was doing, in changing who I was and changing myself into somebody who could be successful.
I appreciate that, Jeff. And the thing is, at this level, when you're approaching the top 1% level, this is the kind of thing that required, it's not nearly just a call volume anymore, just a technique. It really segues into more of the inner essence of people, the way they, you know, think, who they really, what they are. And one thing I would adjust on what you said, Jim, is that you can't change your character. Actually, you can slowly mold your character. Your character changes slowly based on the sum total of everything you are and what you do and what you think. And you can kind of like, you can mold your character into a different direction, but it's certainly not going to change on a dime. So, but if a character element would be someone who's really like hardworking versus kind of slothful and lazy, a person who got rededicated and internally motivated can literally change over to that direction. And that's kind of like a muscle. You don't do lift weights for an hour and a half and all of a sudden have big muscles. You have sore arms, which you have. But over time, if you did a sequence of exercise, you can develop these bigger muscles, right? It just takes time. So character, I think, is more like the muscles where gradually you can change it. And it gradually is a negative way. So if you start doing negative things, your character degrades. Goes both ways. Does anybody have any questions or comments?
Paul, this is Andy.
Yes, Paul, this is Rich. One thing I have to say is that this call, most of all, and all the other calls that you've done like this, really challenges my paradigm in what I've learned in the sales industry. I don't know why everyone else is being quiet, but one of the reasons I was being quiet is that it really began to make me become very introspective and sort of like either this stuff he's saying is really BS or this stuff is really great. And slowly I'm beginning to realize it's really great because we get so much of that other stuff, or I at least have, that it's a big paradigm shift for me. And hopefully I'm switching and I'm moving on to your side and seeing. But this call was definitely very introspective for me. And, sales training I'm used to is not like this. It's the yeah, let's go sell, who made top, and cheer, you can do it too, and never really make you look inside and see what's going on and what are the tenants and what are the foundation of sales that you're building your sales career on. And this is what you're doing for me, and I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Richard. I really appreciate it. It means a lot. And that's the kind of thing I hope to hear back from people that I've, had an influence on them. So, thank you. I think, Amy, you had a comment?
Yes, Paul. I have to agree with Rich. I am in that 30-something age bracket and have grown up being sheltered and somewhat blinded of what reality really is. And I'm sure that there's several of people out there just like me who don't have the information you just gave us. Their parents, like you said, have babied them and held their hand through a lot of situations, college and even on to their careers. And I just think that this information is very, very valuable, and I appreciate that I was given the opportunity to hear it today.
Well, thank you. I mean, I'm happy that I was able to, because this is a little bit of a jazz thing for me today. I kind of riffed off into that angle, and I kind of fit really nicely as part of this overall concept of the top 1%. And so I'm really kind of happy that I was able to create that, you know, on the audio today, and that it worked for you guys. So, great.